I think we have a quorum now, so let's call this meeting to order. Let me get this view. And while we're at it, Representative Gazelka, will you approve the minutes of March 21st for us?
Please, I'll move the minutes of March.
All in favor of that motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say nay. Motion carries. And Representative Wilkin, you want to sit there?
Wherever you want.
Yeah.
Wherever you want to be. We have House File 3593 up, and it's my bill, so...
While Representative Gunther is moving to the witness chair, the Health Committee last night got some information that I thought was interesting to our discussion yesterday about health care taxes. So I'm going to have the page pass that out to members, and also find out it is 30,000 members that are in MCHA. So. Okay, Representative Gunther, you want to move your bill?
I would, Mr. Chairman. I move House File 3593 for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill.
So moved, Representative Gunther.
Okay, Mr. Chairman and members, Minnesota's prevailing wage is unfair. It uses a modal system. The only other state that uses a modal system is California. And to calculate wages, and what this bill's trying to do is just taking it from the modal system to the median, and it also has the wages determined by deed instead of labor and industry, which is much more accurate up-to-date figures. For that, Mr. Chairman, I think I look at what the Attorney General's application of prevailing wage to private property and job zones, and we looked at in Maurer County, there was an ethanol plant that moved to Iowa, and job zones were designed to get good paying jobs as well as property tax collections, property taxable property in greater Minnesota, because we are slowly sinking. We're losing population. We have declining enrollment in schools. We're trying to get out of poverty in southern Minnesota all the way across I-90. There's between 45 and 71% free and reduced lunches. We have a growing senior population. The only way we can come out of this and enjoy the success of the metro area is to get jobs and good paying jobs. And prevailing wage in the Attorney General's ruling is chasing those jobs out of greater Minnesota. And I look at other states' reactions to our job zones, like Wisconsin on the western border, adopted our legislation almost word for word. They are now taking jobs again from Minnesota. So this prevailing wage really put a crimp in getting a little success and relief for greater Minnesota. So, Mr. Chairman, that's why I think this bill is important. And that being said, I would certainly entertain testifiers.
Okay, first we're going to go on our list. Testifiers, first one up is Representative Cox.
That's the way you want it, Mikey?
Okay. Welcome to the committee, Representative. Please introduce yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm State Representative Ray Cox. I represent the Northfield area. I'm not an expert on prevailing wages, but rather I'm someone that deals with them. When I'm not up here, I operate a building construction company that I've done for the last 33 years. I presently have a building project with the state involving work on 11 projects in 5 different counties. That means 5 rates for carpenters, 5 rates for painters, 5 rates for drywallers, and so forth. Changing the way Minnesota's prevailing wage is calculated may not eliminate the number of different rates, but it will certainly bring them closer to the actual wages paid for trades in a county. A new, more realistic calculation will most likely mean fewer payroll changes to comply with prevailing wage provisions. In visiting with associates in the construction industry, I find slightly less objection to the concept of a prevailing wage than I do to the way Minnesota's prevailing wage is established. I will admit that a fair number of business owners feel government has no business imposing a wage for workers and that America's great free market system should be allowed to operate to the best of its ability. However, if you agree to use the prevailing wage system, I hear business owners asking to please use the system that actually samples wages and averages them to arrive at a system that works for everyone. Or if Minnesota does not care to do that, then consider using the Davis-Bacon provisions as many states do. I also find considerable objection to allowing state wage rates to be imported from county to county. It is simply not true that a county in Minnesota does not have actual wage rate for a construction job. All you have to do is inquire for services and you will find what the cost is. It doesn't matter if you are in Rock, Roseau, Redwood, or Rice County. If you solicit carpentry or painting work, you will find a private business that provides you with that service. The average of those workers' wages is the prevailing wage in that county. To pretend that work does not occur in a county and import data from adjoining counties makes no sense. The state gathers mountains of wage data from employers' payroll reporting systems, individual income tax reports, and so forth. There's no shortage of data to establish true and accurate prevailing wages today. Finally, when prevailing wage rates are set artificially high, either by importing artificial data from another county or by using modal calculations, it shuts out that the majority of the local businesses and craft workers from the projects, the very people you are often asking to pay for the projects being constructed. Setting realistic and honest prevailing wage rates bring more people to prevailing wage compliance with their regular day-in and day-out payroll, and thereby creates the opportunity for more people to be involved with and employed on public projects they're paying for with their tax dollars. I urge the committee to support the changes brought forth in House File 3593. Thank you.
Okay. Go to the next testifier. We've got Lynn Reed. I'd ask the testifiers as they come up, would just please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Could my associate, Aaron Twight, be here just to answer questions in case? But, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Lynn Reed. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Taxpayers Association. This is my associate, Aaron Twight, who did a lot of the technical work for the study and is here just in case. You can see why we picked the background for the slide. This man here has an uncanny similarity to a composite of Aaron and myself, so I thought that was kind of appropriate. Kind of looks like us. This is going to be pretty quick. I'll just give you a quick overview of where this is going, and I've only got 9 slides. You should have it in your packet, a copy of the handout. Just who we are, why the study, a little bit on the methodology and findings, and some recommendations that we made in the study. Many of you are probably familiar with us, but this is our logo, I forget what you call this, statement, I don't know. An independent voice for good government and sound tax policy since 1926. We're nonpartisan, nonprofit, member-supported. Our income comes primarily from dues. We also get grants. And we have a 501c3 called the Minnesota Center for Public Finance Research. And we do contract research as well. One caveat on the contract research, no project is accepted by our board of directors unless the client agrees to let MTA retain research and editorial independence. So if they hire us to do a study, it is their study after we finish. And if they don't like what it says, they can bury it. But they can't tell us what to say in the study. And that's, the board is very jealously guards their independence in that regard. Why we did this study is actually ABC approached MTA in 2004 requesting a more comprehensive study of one we did in the late 1990s. And I don't remember the funder of that one. It was very small on school projects only. I believe it was Twin City Builders, I'm not sure, but they had seen that and they asked us to do an update and a more comprehensive study. Our goal in this was to analyze the labor costs under different definitions of prevailing wage. It's important to know that we did not study the claim that higher wages or prevailing wages as they are currently defined result in lower costs from time savings and quality of construction. That was not our object. We think it's beyond the scope of the study. We think it's worth asking. But those claims were not evaluated at all. We just wanted to look at what are the results of applying current prevailing wage law rates versus an alternative or two. And so what we did is obtain the list of public construction projects in Minnesota for 2002 that were readily available given our time constraints and so forth and staff levels. And we included school projects, state building projects, and state transportation projects. We did not include any city or county building projects simply for time constraints and availability of readily available data. We estimated the labor share of total project costs by speaking with architects, various construction people, getting an estimate of what portion of a total project comprises the labor piece. Then we estimated each job class's share of labor costs. I should say Aaron did. I shouldn't really say we. Aaron did the lion's share of this, going through quite tediously developing a list of job classes, something like 30, I believe, and looking at their components given those job distributions in a county. So we tried to be as careful as we could to estimate the labor because we didn't get any direct information from contractors or anything like that other than advice on the components. And then we compared this particular presentation focuses on the deed survey. We compared the deed survey wages to current prevailing wages and summed it for all the projects. We looked at the federal method as well. And to our surprise, the problem with the federal method in Minnesota, anyway, in many places, there haven't been any federally funded projects that require that for a while. So the survey data is, in some cases, the rates, I think, in a couple of cases, were back to the 1990s, early 1990s. It is fairly not up to date, so it's in the study. And by the way, you can, if you'd like a copy, this is the full study here, and I'm just giving a very much shortened version of it. We do have copies in our office, though. I don't believe we posted that online, but maybe we should. Anyway, the methodology for calculating, here's the typical method in many other states. As was mentioned earlier, only two states use the modal method that Minnesota does. The typical method is this. You take hourly wage examples. They're often gathered, but not always, by survey. There are various ways that these are set. But just take these four or five hourly wage examples. You can see them listed there. There's no majority wage. Therefore, the average rate is used. If there had been one more of 1841, then three out of five would consist of a majority, and they would define it as 1841. And in this example, no single wage rate makes up a majority. Therefore, they just average those five rates. And in this case, the average is $17.07 an hour. And Minnesota's method, contrasted using the same, it is done by surveys, often a very low return rate for these surveys. They take the same hourly rates, the modal rate, which means the most frequently occurring rate, is used. In this case, the prevailing wage is $18.41 an hour. Now that's 7.9% higher than the typical method in this particular example. Now these were just made up to illustrate it, so they're not actually from survey data or anything like that. But this is done for each job class in a construction job. Surveys are sent out. We did get data on response rates, and they're in the 10 to 15% range, maximum, maybe 20%. Sometimes I'm off the top of my head here trying to remember that, but it's not an extremely high rate, and in many cases you do literally get four or five surveys back. Now, in terms of our findings, the top table shows the estimated reductions by using the deeds wage survey, and I'll explain that in a minute, but the total project costs that we looked at in those three areas, which were, again, the school projects, state building projects, and state transportation projects, was $1.7 billion in 2002. And we used 2002 because, you know, you may recall in 2004 there was no bonding bill. And so we went back to have completed projects that were pretty well documented. The range of reduction in cost using deeds definition compared to current law definition ranged from $126 million to $171 million, which was 7.4% to 10% of the total project cost. Now below, we show the assumptions that we did on each class of projects. We assumed, we were told a range of what a total project's labor costs are. The low end was 40 and typical was 50. So we assumed 40 to 50% of a total project was labor. And we did both. Instead of just picking one number, we did 40% and 50%. And then that was multiplied by the portion of those labor costs that are covered by prevailing wage. Not every job on a project is covered by prevailing wage. Supervisory positions are not, and there are other definitions that are not covered by prevailing wage. You multiply an estimate of the portion of jobs that are prevailing wage by the 40 to 50% labor costs on a project, and you end up with those on the bottom. School projects, the range of labor costs assumed to be subject to prevailing wages as a percent of total project cost. That's the title there for you, the table title. Ranges for schools from 21% to about a third, a fifth to a third. For state building projects, 28 to 39%, and state transportation, 35 to 45%. So those were the working assumptions. You can read the detail in here if you care to. That summarizes the basic costs we found. Coming off of this, and I'll show you the implications of these recommendations, but as we approached this as laypersons, really, we didn't have a lot of experience with it other than that one short project on schools. And so in our minds, prevailing just means what is common, what's a common wage. And the deed survey for median wages seems to be much heavier coverage, and it's already routinely done. So we would recommend using that just because it's readily available. And it seems, in a common sense way, closer to the definition of prevailing in our minds. And we get that by looking at actual rates of specific counties and the number of returns that they've turned in. And it's difficult to justify calling something prevailing when, in the example we showed, which were, there actually are examples like this, the prevailing definition ends up being the highest of the ones submitted because it's the most commonly occurring. So it's a little odd to call that prevailing just from a common sense point of view. And we also recommended having deed develop corresponding survey for employee benefits. I understand they did a pilot project on that. I'm not sure if they're going to be doing that routinely or not, but they did do a survey for benefits because that's another component. Those benefits were also included in our study, by the way, but I didn't show any examples of that on the listing of hourly rates. Those hourly rates on that slide do not contain benefits, but our calculations do include benefits. If desired, you can test the quality claims by comparing the deed prevailing wage projects with current law projects. Some states have actually done this because they're not rejecting out of hand or accepting out of hand that certain types of construction or construction workers or rates paid. They're not rejecting the claim that it results in faster built buildings and better built buildings. They're saying, let's do an experiment, try to divide the state very carefully with a consensus of all the stakeholders and actually see if in a year or two or whatever the test time is, which one works better, which one saves the most money, because that's the idea. You want to get the most building for the least amount of money, the best quality, most building, or whatever the project is. So at least one state, two, was it Ohio and Kentucky, or that actually did that experiment. We just found out about it, didn't include it in the results other than to mention it. Okay, now this is an example of what the recommendation would mean. Again, the left side is just a repeat of current law, those hourly rates, and you get the same prevailing rates. Now, if you use the deed method, here's what would happen. First of all, it's a survey that is up to a 75% return rate, is our understanding, because it's required. You have to participate in order to be part of, I forget now what it is, but you have to participate to get something. But you have the same hourly rates. In this case, the median is the middle rate. The prevailing wage would be $16.77, which is a reduction of 9.8% from current law methods. And that's our presentation, and I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Representative Mahoney, you have a question.
Our committee, this is a pretty contentious bill from the audience, so I'll try to keep my question. I'll only ask one particular question here. You talked about these projects where you save 20% or 30% or do you have a breakdown of where those projects were? I mean, were the majority of them in the metro area or in the rural area, the greater Minnesota area, or was it evenly split? That would make a significant difference.
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, we do have a detailed listing of the projects in our Appendix A. I believe we had some in nearly every county. I should actually maybe let Aaron answer that, but they are detailed by type of project, and it's covering most of the state.
Well, Mr. Chair,
Representative
Mahoney, probably a better way to determine that would be the dollar value of the projects as they are in the metro area versus greater Minnesota, because the metro area, not just the seven county metro area, but I think you have a in this kind of a discussion, you probably have to expand the metro area greatly. So I'm kind of curious about that, and if you don't have it here, that certainly for me kind of puts your survey in a different light. But
sure. Mr. Reed.
As Mr. Chair and Representative Mahoney, on page 14 of our study,
we don't have that in front of
right,
us.
Right, and I can make copies for the committee to send this to you. We can send you a copy of the whole study if you'd like to have that. But it does pull out it's by county listed by detail out of the $1.7 billion, for example. As I look down, Hennepin has $251 million of the projects, Hennepin alone, out of $1.7 billion. Not in proportion to its population, actually. And the second largest looks like Dakota at $147 million, Washington at $132, Ramsey at $176, actually Ramsey's second. So you add the seven counties up, and it's going to be right at half if you add them up quickly, doing it mentally here. Half of the $1.7 billion is in the metro. Half is in the outside the seven county metro.
Okay, and Mr. Reed, if you could supply copies of those to Mr. Steinhoff for the committee, I think everybody would like to be able to look at that.
I can, Mr. Chair, I can email the copy of the study.
That would be great.
And Mr. Chair, I think for this particular, when you're talking about this particular study, we can't just use the seven county metro area because that would leave out some of our fastest growing counties around the Minneapolis-St. Paul area. I think the metro area for something like this would come from St. Cloud all the way down to below Faribault almost.
Sure.
I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Sure.
Representative Nelson, sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Reed. You're talking about the method you got here, the example, and I'm trying to get my mind on this. The mode method is the one that's on the right that you got on our thing here. The one that you got here, the typical method, is that the medium or is that the means? I mean, I've heard different. You know, what is that method? Is that it says the average there?
Sister Reed.
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, as I understand it, it's the federal method primarily.
Is the one on the left.
Yes, and that's one typically used by states. That if there is no majority, so let's say you there are a large return, there's 100 surveys submitted for a particular job class. I believe this is done by job class. And 51 of those surveys have a single wage, then that is the majority. That's considered the majority of the returns have this single rate, and it's picked. If no single rate emerges as the majority, which is more common than it doesn't, the average is used of the 100, just the straight average. So it's a either-or kind of scenario, and that is the federal method, as I understand it.
Representative Nelson.
So the bill here talks about switching it to the median method. Would this be the method that we're switching it to? Or, and I see your assistant there shaking his head, no.
Right.
Do you have an example of how the median method would affect, in this example here, these wages submitted, what the wage would be?
Yes. Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, that's the last slide.
Okay.
And it shows, and I really wish now that I hadn't used animation on this. But you see the median here. In this case, the same rates, I used the same rates throughout. And that just means the middle. So out of five, you rank them on the median. You rank all the survey rates, and you pick the middle one. And if the middle, if it's an even number, then you pick between the two middle ones as the median. And so it isn't the average, as was mentioned earlier by Representative Cox. In this particular case, it's the median. But the reason we think that's a much better is primarily because of the 75% return rate on the surveys. There's almost a mandatory participation in this survey. It's very comprehensive. And so the difference likely between the median and average is not going to be that great, although you could modify it to just say the average if you wanted to. This we were just looking at it not precisely and technically because we're not that familiar with its application. It's done, and the survey is published every year, and we just said, well, just use that. But it could be modified to say, we won't use the median, we'll use the average. It would be up to the committee, of course.
Because Mr. Reed, I guess I'm looking at this, and what it looks to me is that this is just driving wages down further for the people working on the job. These are the guys that are taking that money home and buying in the local area. They're paying the local taxes, and we're driving their wages down. We're just driving our wages to the bottom. I mean, is this sort of like being Walmartization of the building community?
Mr. Chair and Representative Nelson, I certainly understand that perspective from the workers' point of view who are receiving the 1841. It would be a very unpopular proposal. We are the Taxpayers Association, so we're looking at it a little bit differently, and saying, given the constraints on the budget, and I think we need to have a very open discussion about, is this a priority expense for state government? The ones receiving the wage would say yes, no argument. And I completely empathize with that perspective. It is a very small minority of the state's population. And I think you have to evaluate, given the health care, child care, education, the other pressing issues, is this giving a return on the dollar of public funds that is comparable to some other program that is also needing funds? And I think that is, and it's we're saying, here's the information, have a public discussion, and come to an agreement on what's a priority for the state in terms of state dollars dedicated for this. And I think that's all we're saying.
Mr. Shearer?
Just Representative Nelson.
But aren't these individual workers, aren't they also taxpayers? And if we drive their wages down, they're not going to have as much money to spend at the local grocery store, at the local gas station, on their health care, to pay for their child care. Is that a good thing or not? I mean, if the lower the people's wages, I thought in the Representative Gunther's opening remarks, he talked about that jobs in these zones are supposed to be used to bring better paying jobs out to the rural areas. We're driving the wages down even further. Isn't that counterproductive to what we're trying to do with the Job Z Zone, is get people's wages up so they have more money to spend in their local communities?
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nelson, yes, that what you said is absolutely true. And if you were able to provide more money, say, for sliding fee child care, allowing more people to work, that would also drive their wages up. It's not a net loss necessarily. To the individual making that wage, it is. But I don't believe that individual will lose work because of it. The wage might be lower. And there are other jobs that the wage would be that, because usually, typically, these are union scale. Because those are the ones that come out precisely at a penny, to the penny amount, they typically are the mode in these counties. And so those wages would continue to be paid on other projects. For this particular project, if it's public, it would be lower, which would lower the cost to state government, which would free up more money to put in somebody else's pocket. So it is very much a question of redistribution, absolutely. And it's about what is efficient from an economic perspective, what gives the best return for the taxpayer dollar. You have a legitimate point, and I'm not an economist. Maybe Art Rolnick should do this study or something, because, or Tom Stinson, because those are the questions I think they need to be in open debate. As we looked at the way prevailing wage is determined, we were a little surprised, frankly, at how archaic it was. It just seemed a little bit away from a common sense definition of prevailing. So we're saying this could reduce construction costs, making money available for other projects or other programs for the state, and that discussion needs to be made, I think, needs to be conducted.
You're talking, when you go through here talking about the prevailing wages, did you take into consideration the open bidding process, the competitive bidding process that all these jobs go on? Are there any guarantees that we're going to see these savings that you say we're going to get in here? Could the contractor just bid it a little bit less and put more money in his own pocket, so that therefore driving down the wages of the individual workers, but one individual getting more money out of it, being the owner of the construction company?
Mr. Representative Nelson, there's no guarantee. This is a snapshot back at 2002 after it's done. And the assumption in most of our tax policy recommendations and fiscal policy recommendations are that the market works. It doesn't always work. And I suspect that this is just off the top of my head. If a contractor became known for doing that, that would come out as well eventually, and the market would work. But it doesn't always work, and that's a fact. And so that's one of the strengths of our system, is letting that experiment happen and let the market work. When it doesn't work, tax policy says government should step in. There's certainly differences of opinion when that point happens. But that we generally assume the market does work, and we'll have the debate on when to step in and when not to.
Okay, Representative Spallett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a comment and then I have a quick question. You know, frankly, I'm having a lot of trouble taking your study very seriously. You know, we can come out with your study today, and then we have a brochure that's given to us by the group that paid you to have the study saying that this is a bad law. I mean, most studies that we have here as legislators have a lot of credibility. They're nonpartisan. They're research oriented. So it doesn't seem credible nor valid. And it's hard for us to take it seriously when you said things like you're speaking with architects to get the cost of projects, but you don't have the real project costs, right? And let me say also, and you said several times you're making assumptions, and several times you said you don't have a lot of experience. So my main question is about taking the actual statistics. You were guessing on those, right? You didn't have any actual statistics to go from, and why didn't you use actual statistics?
Mr.
Chair, Representative Follett, I'd say it's an educated guess in that we do have the total project costs. We do have the labor portions. There's quite a bit of detail at the state level for many of these projects, and when there wasn't, we didn't use it. What we don't know is the precise job mix of the labor costs. That's one of the assumptions. So how many were actual laborers? How many were full carpenters? How many were journey carpenters and so forth, apprentices, things like that? We didn't get from contractors detailed information. That would have been a massively more difficult study. So what I'd ask of members is to read through the full study, and we are lay people. In terms of this, we try to bring a common sense approach to it. We consult with various people in the industry to say, are these assumptions valid or not, and not tied necessarily to the people who are funding the study. Try to get an independent assessment. Are these numbers look reasonable? And I guess all we can ask members is to look through the full study and see if they're reasonable assumptions. I think if you get into the details of the way these surveys are conducted now, the quality of the survey, the return rate of the survey, I think any reasonable person could conclude there has to be a better way to define prevailing wage. Better in the sense of more typical of what's actually being paid in this industry, not better for the person making the higher wage. I'm granting that, but that is not an acceptable result for someone earning a higher wage. If this method lowers their wage, it's not acceptable to that person. It does lower their income, it lowers their tax payments. That's absolutely true. So read through the study, look at our assumptions, and this is only the second time we studied prevailing wage. We are more expert in tax policy. That's absolutely true. We're not trained economists. That's true. So keeping all that in mind, we took our best shot at, as primarily private citizens who spend a lot of time studying government, and saying, is this a reasonable way to define prevailing wage? And given the experience of other states too, the uniqueness of Minnesota's method is only one of two states. So it is what it is, and we don't want to claim for it to be more than what it is. We're just presenting what we did with the limited staff and budget that we had.
Okay, Representative Wallace, we have Representative Clark, Westerberg, and Gazelle, and then we need to move on to the next one.
So comment, I'll just say, you probably said it all with it, it is what it is. And in my mind, I'll look at the full study, but it doesn't seem that it really is taking in very accurate information about prevailing wage. Yes.
Representative Clark.
Well, one really good thing I heard you say was, I think I heard you make a statement about that you support Minnesota Taxpayers League might support higher wages for those hardworking child care workers. Right?
Representative Clark, there needs to be a distinction made. They're not the Taxpayers League, it's the Taxpayers Association.
Excuse me, you're correct. The Taxpayers Association. Can we, is that, we can count on you for a statement like that when we try to raise child care workers' wages? That was my first very positive response to what you said.
Mr. Reeder. Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, that is certainly a program that would compete with dollars saved or construction dollars reduced. We wouldn't make a recommendation like that. We wouldn't oppose it or recommend it. We would say that is one competing choice.
So it's just for this discussion, but you don't really mean it. Okay. I just actually want to ask a question kind of built on what Representative Stalwick said, which is, I think what you're talking about in terms of the deed survey is the requirement, the corporate subsidy reform law, that was a bipartisanly passed law years ago that said when we give a public subsidy, we want to know what we get for it. But I see two major exceptions to that in your methodology here. First of all, you said you did no city or county building projects. So even though you're referencing counties, metro counties, greater Minnesota counties, you didn't take all the information that is available at DEED that would have given you information on those city or county building projects. You only talked about the state dollar. I don't know why you did that. I wonder what the difference would be. It's a big, big pot of money out there, so I guess that's one of the big failings in this. I would think you should think about that. I'd like to ask you to think about it. And then I don't understand why you also did not look at the quality and savings issues. You admit that right up front.
Mm-hmm.
You did not study whether or not higher wages result and lower cost from time savings and quality of construction. Why not?
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Clark, our budget was $11,000. and two people. States that have tried to do that have done it primarily through a year or two test of actual construction projects to is clearly beyond what we could do, and that's why we included it as one of the recommendations. If you want to test that, that is way beyond the scope. I would think a consulting company would probably charge a couple $100,000 to do even a little bit more than what we did. We don't price ourselves that way, and we don't promise something that they might promise. But in terms of the cities and counties, we couldn't find a centrally located place for the detail that we needed even to make the assumptions we made, given the time that we had. So that is, you need to know that up front, that we're not saying this is the absolute final word, comprehensive, prevailing wage study forever. We had to set the scope for what it was in the months that we had to do it, and that's, I would love to hear back, after you read the study, if we've made too high a claim for it, we would want to be very aware of that, because we don't want it to be more than it is. And the city and county projects, we just couldn't find the centrally located data to do it in the time that we had.
Mr. Chairman, my final comment on that last comment is Deed has it, and if you really were looking at Deed, you'd have found it. But I just think what you just said tells us how the quality of the study.
Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. And I guess first I have a comment, too, is I think I'm really looking forward to seeing the report along the lines of Representative Mahoney's questioning here as far as geography is concerned. I think it's really important to look at the type of projects, too, and how that was determined. But my question is in your brochure here, it seems to show that Minnesota's an island here. You know, we're one of very few states that apparently does this, providing for a prevailing wage, and we're unique. And my question is in the brochure it gives the impression that no other state practically is doing this, and in your study there, can you tell me for a fact that the other states do not provide any other method for determining a wage to be paid for certain projects?
Mr. Reed, Mr. Chair and Representative, most states do provide prevailing wage for prevailing wage laws. It's the fact that only Minnesota and California use the modal method. Other states typically use the federal method for calculating prevailing wage. So,
thank you.
Okay, Representative Gazelka, and we need to move on to the next witness.
Yeah, I'll make this brief, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reed, I appreciate the fact that I believe you're trying to give us good numbers and that you're open to more data and that you only had a fixed budget to work on, but it appears that as a state, minimally, we're paying more than $1 billion in a four-year period for these projects, and we don't do that on health care or anything else. We look at what is the best way to use tax dollars. But so I think we really do need to take a hard look at this, and this, if this means we need more data, so be it. But I think Representative Clark's question as far as quality is a good one. And you had mentioned the Ohio study. Is that something that we can get a hold of or that you have that we can look at, whether quality was hampered by this?
Mr. Reed.
Mr. Chair, Representative Gazelka, I believe it actually was Kentucky.
Both states
did it. And we will send, along with the study, when we email it, we'll send the links for those studies for members to look at.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next testifier will be Jake Bowerly.
You both signed that, right? Okay.
Thank you. morning.
Introduce yourself and proceed.
Jake Bowerly. I'm the COO of Bowerly Brothers, a highway contractor from St. Cloud, Minnesota. A little background. I come to you not as a Democrat or Republican, but as a concerned citizen and a taxpayer. Little background. My brother Jerry was in the House from 1986 to 94 as a Democrat, my father and my mother both supported Humphrey back in the 60s, anyway, my background is I spent 3 years at Harvard learning global competitiveness, and why I come here today to speak to you is my concerns about some of those issues. My brother Brian went to China, I was in China in June with my Harvard class, and brother Brian was with the governor in August, and we try to keep ourselves educated about global economics. And the concern I have is, example, we had last month in Todd County, Minnesota. We work in, we employ about 800 people, and we're affiliated with Knife River Corporation, which together with them in Minnesota, we employ about 1,600 people. And we worked in 35 out of 87 counties in the last 5 years. My Todd County example I referred to, last month we did a job in Todd County as a $3 or $4 million job to overlay some roads and widen them and make safety improvements. And in a county where the average wage is, manufacturing wage is $12 to $14, a truck driver, will make between $16 and $17 an hour. In this county, the prevailing wage was $26.11, and the fringe benefit was $11.70. And the market value of these two brackets would be $16.50 and $4.50. For a total of $21 is the market in that area for a truck driver to do those services. And this contract called for $27.80, a 30% increase. And this law, like many laws, started out to be a great idea to meet a need and satisfy a great purpose. But over time, it's a life of its own and migrates towards unintended consequences. This law, when it first came out, contractors were paying $4 and $5 an hour, and there was five people waiting for every job. Unemployment rates were much higher, and in this market, contractors are going to have to, unemployment rates of 4 and 5%, contractors have to pay competitive market prices to get quality people. And the quality issue was brought up, and that's a great concern of all of us, and what the counties and state have done is they've implemented quality measures, like there's ride incentives and density incentives and all kinds of incentives for contractors to do the quality thing right. So contractors were not going to hire people that aren't skilled or sacrifice quality to save a couple of dollars in labor and lose it all in incentives. But getting back to my example, when you figure in the other benefits and overtime, our Todd County wage we did that day was $44.47 per hour. $44.47 per hour was the wage we did for our truck drivers in Todd County, and that job had probably 25 truck drivers, because you bid a 60-hour week, a short season, and so on and so forth, but that's the number we had to bid in that contract to meet that contract completion dates and so forth. In a county where the average manufacturing wage is $12 to $14, we really want to pay $44.47 for a truck driver in Todd County. Was that the intent of this law? And what happens is, in the Twin Cities metro area, that might be the market. But what happens is, it migrates out. The law says that if you have a highway that goes from Wright County to McLeod County, and McLeod County is $22 and Wright County is $28, the contract says you shall pay the higher of the two. So the 28 now becomes the mode for McLeod County. The next year, McLeod County and and the neighboring county have a joint project, and then it migrates out further. So what happens is the metro wage scale becomes the wage scale for the state. And we all know the cost of living in the metro is much higher than it is in Todd County or Benton County or rural counties. So it's a well-intended law, but over time, it mutates into something that gives you unintended consequences, I believe. And contractors, prevailing wage is a minimum wage, too. That's another thing you have to understand. In certain categories, we pay much higher than the prevailing wage because the market demands it. To get certain skills, certain crafts, you will pay higher than the prevailing wage. But the free market will determine the price, except when the prevailing wage is too high, then that determines the price. It wasn't about 8 years ago, we could pave a mile of road for $20,000. And now with labor, prevailing wage, and energy and so forth, the cost is now $60,000 per mile. So what happens with these rules is Todd County, where the farmers and the manufacturers are trying to compete globally, they can only afford to pave half their road now, or 4 miles instead of 8 miles, or they're getting half the bang for the buck they used to get because of some of these rules and other things that come across the line. But the other part of the concern about is that, you know, the funding for highways right now is gas tax and motor vehicles sales tax, and now bonding. We're borrowing from the future. We're borrowing from our kids to pay higher than market wages today. Is that what we want to do? Is that so? Those are some of the concerns that I have addressed in this group today.
Okay, thank you very much. I think we need to go on to the next testifier. Does someone have a question? Okay, seeing none. Next one would be Robert Heisey. No, he's not going. Nancy Jones.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you for allowing me to speak today. I am the owner for 25 years now.
Could you please introduce yourself for the record?
Oh, my name is Nancy Jones.
Thank you.
I am the owner for 25 years now of a roofing company located in Bloomington. I'm also the 2006 chairman of the board for the Minnesota Associated Builders and Contractors. As a contractor, it's my feeling that Minnesota's prevailing wage law is unfair. Minnesota and California, as you've heard, are the only states that use the modal method to calculate wages, and this method is an inaccurate calculation and not statistically valid. It's time for Minnesota to join the rest of the country in creating a prevailing wage law that's truly prevailing. This modal method, it's outdated. It's an invalid method that leaves Minnesota overpaying up to 10% on state construction projects, and it's not fair to the taxpayers. That amounted to $171 million in 2001-2002. A lot of this information was from the Minnesota Taxpayers Association study. But as you've heard, most states and the federal government use the two approaches to determine prevailing wage, and that's just a mode that I think we should move to. The deed collects the data determining these benefits, and since that data is all collected, it would just be the way to take this information from. I have some numbers here that I'll give you that are from the Department of Labor and Industry and the Department of Employment and Economic Development web pages. And my roofing company is currently, as I speak, working on a prevailing wage project. For me to do this work, the wage is $40.84 per hour. $11+ of this rate is for benefits. Now, my company pays our employees medical premium. We have a health reimbursement plan that pays 50% of their out-of-pocket expenses. We have a flexible benefits program. We offer a 401k plan and match their contributions at 4% of their wages. We pay their premium for a death and disability policy. We pay sick and vacation time, and we also offer dental insurance coverage. Yet our benefits are not recognized as a registered program, so therefore we are required to pay the full $40.84 per hour and continue to give them our benefits. Compare this $40.84 to the OES data for roofers in the Twin Cities, which is $25.22. If you add 30% for benefits, so we're comparing apples to apples, the wage would be $32.79, over $8 an hour less. This difference is what keeps me from performing more public work. For comparison purposes, I looked up the numbers for a roofer in St. Louis County, and there's an even greater disparity there. Prevailing wage is $36.85, including benefits. The OES data, using a median wage, including 30% for benefits, is $26.99. That's nearly $10 an hour difference. How is a rural contractor supposed to pay $10 more per hour than the market rate? In conclusion, the current prevailing wage method is not truly prevailing, and it prices some contractors out of bidding public work. For an example, we did a project several years ago, got the bid together, gave the contractor the price, and the contractor said, oh, by the way, did I tell you it's prevailing wage? No, you didn't, so we better get the numbers back and relook at it. We had to bump the price up 10-15%, gave it back to them. We got the job, did the work, same employees, same end result, and the owners, the taxpayers, had to pay that additional 10-15%. And that's just the reality of the way the system is now, and it would be very refreshing to see some changes made.
Thank you for your testimony, Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Jones?
Correct.
You said you're the president of the Associated Builders Contract?
Chairman of the board.
Chairman of the board. Could you tell me and the committee how many construction workers, not architects, not engineers, not secretaries, bond boys, that deal. And how many construction workers are associated with the ABC?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, no. I would have to, I can tell you contractor firms, but the actual workers, you know, that depends. There's different sizes of companies within the organization. Some may have, you know, 1,000 employees. Some may have 100.
Well, Mr. Chair, it would be good for us to know how many actual construction workers are those are the people who would be affected by this particular change in law. Now, often the office will have, hopefully, one office person per 3 or 5 construction workers. So if you could get us the number, I would really appreciate that, as to just the construction workers, not the lawyers, not the estimators, not just the people affected by the prevailing wage.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I will do my best to get you that information.
Or I'll just ask Mr. Miller and have him in my office and enjoy the time.
Good idea. Okay, thank you for your testimony. I appreciate
it. Thank
you. Tom Snyder?
Good morning. I'm Tom Snyder. I live in the southwest suburbs of the metro area, and I'm speaking to you today as just a concerned citizen. I don't have a business that's going to be directly affected by this law change, so I'm just approaching this as a concerned citizen. I do consult as an employee benefit consultant with a lot of different companies around the metro area, and as a result, I do see the effect that this law has on them and their ability to employ people in the out in the metro area. So I will say that. I'm asking you, as a concerned citizen, to strongly consider how we do calculate our wages as they relate to prevailing wage law. If the reports that I've read are correct, we're spending somewhere between $80 and $85 million more on construction costs than we need to. Now, as a citizen, I look at that and say, gee, if we're off by 50% on that report, or we're off by 70% on that report, we're still talking about a whole bunch of meaningful dollars. A lot of money's at stake. So I think you need to strongly consider the fact that we are one of two states applying the mode rule as we calculate prevailing wage. And we should very strongly consider an average or median prevailing wage, or we should change the name of the law, because obviously a mode wage is not a prevailing wage, as it's been stated by the previous speakers. The current law settles to the most common wage paid, which is usually the union wage. And while I have absolutely nothing against unions, I do think that it's inaccurate and misleading to think that one organization has the correct answer as to what the correct wage should be for a given area. I do find that is an interesting point. It's a fairly simple process or problem to fix. If we change the prevailing wage law to settle to the median wage, as reported by the Minnesota Department of, the Minnesota Department of Employment and Economic Development, this data is already collected for unemployment benefit purposes, so it's readily available and it won't add anything to administrative costs. As a city and as a county, as a state, and as a nation to go larger, we've got a lot of issues that we need to address. We were talking earlier about, or it's been mentioned earlier, that there's obviously concerns about our medical care delivery and financing system. As a taxpayer, I think all you really need to do is go on to the web, on the internet, and look at a web page that is www.dhs.state.mn.us and go to Project 2030. And I'm sure you guys, everybody here is more familiar with that than I am. But it scares me to think about the demand, or the future demand on our state financial resources and what we're going to need to do to meet those demands. And I think by tweaking issues like prevailing wage is a good first step on addressing those future financial demands. So I'm asking you, as a concerned and private citizen, to strongly consider changing the way we address prevailing wage law, either change it from a mold to an average, or at least change the name of the law. Thank you for your time, and I appreciate your consideration, and have a good day.
Thank you very much. Next on the list would be John Nessie. I'm pronouncing that right. John Nessie in. Mr. Anfang, would you like to go, and then we'll get him up next if he's in the room? Mr. Anfang, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Dick Anfang. I'm the president of the Minnesota State Building and Construction Trades Council, representing over 50,000 working members in the construction industry in the state of Minnesota, which includes approximately 8,000 registered apprentices in training for the future workforce of this state. As the previous speaker indicated, or attempted to, I'd like to correct something. The Minnesota State Building Trades is the umbrella union of the construction working local unions in this state, and I nor our unions set prevailing rate of wages. It's not in my job description. I hope it never is. The state of Minnesota, through the modal process in the Department of Labor and Industry, sets it. and the state, the United States government uses that method also. And as you would suppose, I stand here in opposition to this bill. And one very clear distinction so far is that I have the privilege of representing workers. The folks here that have testified in support of this bill are primarily contractors. Huge difference. One of the things that, or several of the things that make the construction industry stand apart from other industries is the history of protections that exist for both workers and contractors, union and non-union. Prevailing wage laws reflect the best of these practices and protections. In repeated economic studies, prevailing wage laws have been shown to maintain quality standards on government projects by providing a fair playing field on which competition is based on efficiency, quality, and productivity to support local wage rates and training programs to reduce occupational injuries and to add stability to what otherwise might be an unstable labor market. The empirical evidence in many studies is clear and consistent. The stronger the prevailing wage laws, the greater the benefits for the community. Of special interest to this committee, prevailing rates, because of their significant positive externalities, provide a favorable impact on state budgets. I'll focus my comments on the impact of the proposed shift from the modal method of calculating prevailing rates to the weighted or average or mean and the OES rates. Minnesota is currently one of several states in the federal government on which prevailing wages are paid on the largest number of workers in the same field, typically called the modal method. This method defines prevailing wage as the wage paid. The proposed method would define prevailing wages as the wages paid to 50% or more of the workers in the same class, or if less than 50% of the workforce make up the same wage, the weighted average of all wages in the area is considered prevailing. This new wage is and will generally lower the amount currently paid, and lowering the wages in the construction industry is not what the industry needs. In the near future, retirees are going to be leaving the industry, and the industry is having difficulty bringing new people in, people that want a career in the construction industry. It's difficult at today's rates. It's going to be much more difficult if this bill passes and wages are lowered. It becomes less and less attractive, and this is a wage-lowering bill. According to its proponents, this bill is intended to do nothing more than simplify the current law. However, to describe the changes in this way is, as they say, to put a wolf in sheep's clothing. This bill is a significant step toward the erosion of protections and standards set by Minnesota's current prevailing wage law, and will have an adverse effect and impact on construction workers, the communities they live in, and the state's financial resources. The current measure of prevailing wage rates has several advantages. First, unlike the mean or average, it avoids the impacts that an abnormal distribution of data might have on an average. Secondly, it does not require large-scale surveys. Written contracts, when they exist, provide information that is both reliable and less costly to obtain. This bill would significantly weaken the substantial benefits provided by the law and shift the number of costs from employers to the state. Empirical studies consider the impact of both repealing state prevailing wage laws and revising the method of rate calculation from mode to mean. Studies done in several states, including Utah, California, Wisconsin, and Minnesota, conclude that weakening or repealing prevailing wage laws result in the following. Lower wages for all construction workers. Like other labor market regulations, prevailing rate of wages sets a standard. Without that standard, the wages paid to all workers would likely decline. The California study, which specifically estimates the impact of shift of a modal calculation to a mean, estimated a reduction in construction workers' salaries of 8%. Now that's a that's across the board, not just to the prevailing rate, to the highest workers. It's across the board. And I'd like to repeat, without this standard, the wages paid to all workers would likely decline. We're affecting the entire labor market here. Increased cost overruns, the competitive bidding nature of this, without the current modal system, empirical studies indicate a 5.3% increase in cost overruns. The studies indicate lower quality construction because, as they say, you get what you pay for, as was evidenced by the study promoted here today, suggesting that we reduce construction workers' wages by $170 million based on an $11,000 study. In construction, you get what you pay for, and evidently in studies, you get what you pay for. Since on government projects, the lowest bid is accepted, contractors are left to compete by hiring the cheapest labor possible. The economic reality is as though if you hire cheaper workers, you get a lower quality product. A severely weakened system of construction apprenticeship training programs. In construction, this could lower the wages by as much as 40% on apprentices. Both because union apprenticeship programs have reduced funding under this proposed law, and because workers less interested in lower wage jobs will not apply to work in the industry. In the only study of its type, Billingsley found that the, quote, the repeal or weakening of prevailing wage laws affects apprenticeship programs, skill formation, and in the long run, productivity, unquote. Using Thibault's measures of the strength of prevailing wage law, Billingsley found that in states with strong laws have apprenticeship rates of 13% higher than average law states, 61% higher than weak law states, and 82% higher than no law states. Apprenticeship is the future of the industry. Not only will we be less likely to attract the highest quality workforce to the state's projects, but there will be fewer trained craftspeople, and this is not what the industry needs. Increased occupational injuries, increased costs to workers' compensation, estimates of the impact from which a modal calculation to a mean are that injuries will increase by 8%, severe injuries by 5%, and if the law were repealed, repealed altogether, it has been shown that occupational injuries could increase by 15%. Also, the studies indicate a lower minority participation in construction job training programs and increased minority unemployment in the skilled trades. They show reduced tax revenues available to state governments. Workers will have less income, often enough to drop into a lower tax bracket, and because they have less money, they buy less. The latter impacts not only the state sales tax they pay, but the incomes of local merchants. And in California, for example, this would have meant a loss in state income and sales taxes of approximately $300 million. Moreover, because it is likely that lower levels of benefits will be offered, costs such as health care will become socialized, the state will pay for what the contractors no longer pay for. Because so many critics of the prevailing wage laws focus on cost savings for the state, let's turn our attention for a minute to the actual impact of repeals and revisions in prevailing wage rates on state budgets. While an initial adjustment in prevailing wage laws may seem to save the state money because a particular project may be of lower cost, the net effect would be that the state loses money because of the reasons I just outlined. Reduced tax revenues, increased workers' compensation claims, increased socialization of costs of health care benefits, not to mention the reduced sales tax revenues that result from reduced consumption or from the frequency of cost overruns and repairs necessary on these projects. Utah, Wisconsin, and California all saw a net loss in their studies. A study done at the University of Minnesota concludes, and I quote, that the preponderance of available evidence suggests that the cost impact for prevailing wage requirements in Minnesota is negligible. It is likely that Minnesota, like other states studied, would see a net loss in state funds if this bill passes. The evidence is clear. Weakening the state's prevailing wage law by shifting from a modal calculation to a mean or average reduces the positive externalities provided to Minnesota by the prevailing wage law. Good wages mean good business, fair work conditions mean fair competition, and a quality workforce means quality construction. And all of this means higher tax revenues for the state and a stronger local economy. Taken together, these economic studies reaffirm the policy of Minnesota's prevailing wage law. It's right in there, 177.44. Quote, it is in the public interest that public buildings and other public work be constructed and maintained by the best means and highest quality of labor reasonably available. Unquote. It is also clear from these studies that laws are working. A report from the Minnesota Department of Labor and Industry that reviewed many of these same studies concluded, quote, the evidence finds that not only is prevailing wage legislation doing what it is intended to do, but absent such a provision, the effects are harmful to the industry and to the local economy. This bill is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Changing the method of calculating rates seems harmless, but as repeated economic studies have shown, these changes have significant impacts on workers' lives and the quality of our state-funded projects and our state revenues. Members, it's been said that this current system does not reflect the true wages paid in rural Minnesota. I would argue the current system works best because the determinations are made at the county level, and they're not made regionally, they're made at the county level. There's surveys of what really exists in each county, in each of your communities. And the surveys say that the most, and the results are, that the prevailing rate is based on that wage which is most commonly paid in the counties. That's how it's set. It's not set in the metro. It's not imported from the metro to rural Minnesota. If a contractor obtains work in a metro contractor and he wants to go out there in rural Minnesota and pay the rural rate, it's typically 25% less than the metro rate. Those are the most commonly paid wages in rural Minnesota. Under the current system, construction rates are set, and this is very interesting. Approximately 50% of the rates that are set based upon collective bargaining agreements. Most of that in the metro area. The other 50% are set by rates other than collective bargaining, primarily those rates paid by ABC contractors and non-union contractors. It's already being done 50% of the time in the state of Minnesota by other than collective bargaining agreements. The strong proponents, as you've heard of this, as the Associated Builders and Contractors, a relatively small contractor association and typically non-union. What they would like to see is not 50% of the rates set by the non-union. They'd like to see 100% of the rates set by something other than collective bargaining. That's what they'd like to see. And why would they like to see that? They'd like to see that because they would not have to then pay their workers at what is the most commonly paid rate. They could pay it at whatever rate they determine. In the private sector, it takes one person in a non-union setting to set the rate for each worker in the shop. One person, that's the employer. At least under the modal system, you require the most commonly paid to set the wage for the public work performed in that county. They'd like to take the money, that $171 million, out of the workers' pocket and put it in theirs. Representative Clark, I don't think very much would dwindle down or trickle down to the health care workers in this state from the result of changing this law. This bill indeed would, over time, drop wages and benefits far below the current rates. And I would suggest to you that what is attempting to be done by this bill, by the ABC and its supporters, is to do to the construction industry what Walmart has done to the retail industry in this state and across this country. Drive the wages to the lowest possible wage, sell the product as low as you possibly can, put the burden of health care and pensions and Social Security, retirement benefits on the worker and not the corporation. You'd be paying the corporate gods instead of paying the workers. And I ask you, please, to consider all of these factors when deliberating. We are more than willing to work, and I have stated this in Chairman Gunther's committee in the past. We are always willing to look at how we might be able to sit down collectively as an industry and try and make sure all people understand how the law works. And if there are some things that we think could improve it, some things have been suggested, we'd like to sit down and do it. We'll study it. But the need to change this law and throw the baby out with the bathwater is not the way to do it. I thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Mr. Anfang. I have a question for you. I understand your dislike of moving from the mobile system to the median. What about changing the survey from the Department of Labor and Industry survey to the deed survey, which is already out there, and it seems to have a much better response rate? We get more accurate numbers. Doesn't necessarily dictate, I don't know if it would go up or down, but it's certainly a better sample size.
I would disagree with that wholeheartedly. My understanding of the OES data is that there are, instead of per craft reports, I'll give you an example, carpenter. How many people are carpenter? Boom, they shoot the carpenter right out there. They don't ask, is the carpenter an apprentice? Is the carpenter a foreman? Is the carpenter this? Is the carpenter that? And there are many different types of carpenters. That's why there's different calculations in the Department of Labor, because there's different wages for different skill levels of carpenters. And so to say whatever they send in that says a carpenter is a carpenter is not true in our workforce. It's not accurate at all. It's generalizing what a trade is in one statement and does not truly reflect wages that are paid to workers. Sheet metal workers are the same way. Electricians are the same way. Roofers are the same way. There's different levels that can be paid to them for different skill levels, and they lump it all together, and then they average it. In no way does it reflect the skill levels that if you spend 4 or 5 years in an apprenticeship program and attain the highest skill level, you should have that. You should have that wage coming to you. And they just throw an average out there, and it's not, in my opinion, accurate at all.
If we were able to get Deed to drill down and get those different, apprentice or whatever, the different levels of each trade, and we got more accurate information in that way, but we had a much better sample size, would that be supportable?
No.
It's an honest answer. I don't agree with it, but it's an honest answer. Representative
Ruth. Customer, because they're pretty direct to the point.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's taking a long time. I don't want to belabor this, but I appreciate your comments, Mr. Anfang, and I certainly agree with apprenticeship in our community, in our district. We've had a top team together with manufacturing, working together with business, and it's been very, very effective. But just to make a short statement, coming from the business world, and what I'm hearing from our constituents is that they're having a tough time putting that amount of money into paying this. Not that anyone wants to have anyone take a lesser pay, but what happens in business, if you have to cut expenses, what does that mean? It means we cut jobs. And so I'd have to disagree that it would take wages down for everybody. What I'm seeing, what I'm hearing from my constituents is that it is, in some of the businesses, they are not able to hire the people that they need. They could be hiring more people in the rural area because they can't pay these these fees, and or they're putting the money to that. They have to put the money to that. And another issue is when we look at the schools. I mean, when they're paying these costs, I mean, we can directly say, I mean, the schools get X amount of dollars, and then how we want them to have local control for how they use that. But, you know, we want the money to go to the classroom. We want the money to go to the kids and the teachers. And so that I see that as a great concern.
Mr. Chairman, if I could...
Mr. Anthony, please.
Representative Ruth, I would respectfully disagree with you a little bit in terms of workers in rural Minnesota. I believe that they would like to have as high a wage as they can in relation to the skill that they've developed. And I think evidence of that is the gravitation from rural Minnesota to the more populous areas where more work is being done and higher wages are being paid across the board. I think that's an issue that the state needs to consider. And certainly Job Z does that. And Job Z wages should be reflective of the community's wages. And I believe they are. And that's the fundamental difference that we have here. So there's a lot of issues the state needs to work on. But cutting wages, which this bill would do, to a significant number. Construction is 8% of the gross national product. I believe it's at least that in the state of Minnesota. It's a very significant part. And if you cut wages of 8% of the people, you are, and that's just in construction, you have the potential here to cut wages across the board by this one action. It's very, very serious.
Okay, we got Representative Westerberg, and then we need to take the testimony of Mr. Nessie, and we've got two bills where there's people from out of town that we'd like to cram in here, at least get the testimony in. So Representative Westerberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be real brief. It's one of those things where, you know, this is really an interesting bill. It's going to be tough because, you know, it's the way things seem to be going everywhere. I mean, the writing seems to be on the wall that states are all trying to be competitive and everybody's fighting for that dollar. But Mr. Reed made a statement that I'd like to ask you your opinion on, and that was basically he said something to the effect that sometimes or the prevailing wage turns out to be a minimum wage because of our free market system, and that wages are paid that are higher than that. Could I get your response to that particular statement?
Mr. Anthony.
It's true that the prevailing rate as established through the model system is the minimum that's required by the contractor to pay. Okay. Certainly, an individual is worth more to that employer. He can pay them. It's not, doesn't say you have to pay him exactly this. You have to pay him that as a minimum. Now, certainly, I don't really understand his response either, so it's difficult for me to respond to that. But it is a minimum. It is a minimum standard. And I guess I don't understand his statement either.
Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Nesty, you'd please introduce yourself and proceed with your testimony. Thank you, Mr. Anson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Nessie. I'm here testifying in place of Gary Thaden. I'm here representing construction employers, nearly 1,000 of them that employ over 10,000 workers. I'll list the names of the contractor associations that I represent today. The Carpentry Contractors Association, the Minnesota Drywall and Plaster Association, Minnesota Environmental Contractors Association, Minnesota Floor Covering Contractors Association, Minnesota Painting and Wall Covering Employers Association, the Thermal Insulation Contractors Association, and the Minnesota Chapters of the International Millwright Contractors Association, the Minnesota Mechanical Contractors Association, and the Minnesota Chapter of the National Electrical Contractors Association. You know, my employers and I disagree with Mr. Ang Fang pretty regularly, but this is something that we agree on. The current system works. The current prevailing wage system works. It's what's best for the employers that I represent. It's what's best for the employees that Mr. Ang Fang represents, and it's what's best for the state of Minnesota. The proposed changes would have a negative impact on all three of those groups. The prevailing wage system is designed to protect against the importation of wages from low-wage areas into high-wage areas, and it's designed to keep vulnerable workers working at living wages with benefits. The proposed bill here would change the basis for the survey of the wages from what is currently 87 Minnesota counties to what I believe it's 13 economic development regions. And broadening the regions in which the surveys are conducted would reduce the ability of the system to protect against the importation of wages first. The deed median is also, or any median, is also not the right number for a prevailing wage rate. And contrary to what Mr. Eng thinks, the prevailing wage is not a minimum wage. It's a journeyman wage. And there are employers are free to employ apprentices in state-registered programs on prevailing wage jobs at those wage levels, which are below the prevailing wage rate based on a percentage of that. There are numerous studies that show the benefits of prevailing wage rates, the most prominent of which was conducted at the University of Utah by a team of economics professors, perhaps bipartisan, but certainly neutral, commonly referred to as the Utah study, and it studies the effects of reducing or repealing the prevailing wage rates in 9 states. It's sort of a landmark research paper. That study and numerous others showed that lowering prevailing wage rates does not result in savings to state or state governments or federal governments. Change orders, repairs, and additional costs associated with lower quality construction projects, along with the reduced tax base, actually end up costing the state more. So you'd be achieving those things, because those additional costs, implementing this bill would result in lower quality construction projects, lower wages paid to employees on state jobs, and it would cost the state more to achieve those things. So in summary, I guess I'd like to say that this bill would not be good for employers, it would not be good for workers, and it would not be good for the state. Additionally, it would not achieve the goal that the state seeks to achieve. I urge the committee to reject this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nesty. For a very brief question, Representative Mahoney.
Right, I have a couple of actually. Two brief questions are, Mr. Nesty, is there a way that you could email Mr. Steinoff or the committee where we could find that Utah study?
Absolutely.
And then I just want to make sure on a number that you threw out there that you were testifying today for contractors that your organization represents of 1,000 or better?
Yes, 9 subcontractor associations that are comprised of nearly 1,000 employers.
Did you have the mechanical contractors in there also?
Yes, yes. And mechanical and electrical.
Mm-hmm. Well, just, and this is to the committee, I put the numbers together of actual construction contractors from this ABC, not the lawyers, not the architects, not the everybody else, and it was under 300 construction companies versus 1,000. And
roughly.
I'm sure there's a few more out there that you don't represent.
That's correct.
So just, that's my comment.
Yeah. Representative Sturt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'll be very brief because my bill is one of those. But at the same time, I haven't spoke yet today, and I just want to get a little bit on record here. We heard a lot of testimony today about assumptions. There's an assumption that there's going to be savings. There's an assumption that this money could potentially be used for health care or schools or classrooms. But Representative Ruth, those construction workers that built the school have kids in those classrooms and need to put food on the table at the end of the day. There's the assumption that if we spend less on construction workers, it's going to save our health care system or save money for it. But in two respects, through lower wages and benefits, they could potentially, they could drive it down to where they have to use subsidized health care, and that's taxpayer dollars. And it's just, and this isn't a shot, this is more of an observation. I'm definitely not taking a shot here, but we're looking at how we're paying construction workers, who are middle-class workers, and we equate it to the health care system. When there are CEOs of HMOs who use directly or indirectly government dollars that make over $100 million a year, yet we don't fill up committee hearing rooms to talk about those salaries. We talk about squeezing the middle class again. I come at this, I love construction workers, and that's just because there's probably a ton of them sitting in the back and I have to walk by them when I leave. Or that I'm sitting next to one of them right now. It's not for that reason, though.
Two of them.
It's because you, and in your passing a bonding bill, it's because they do a job we can't outsource. You can't send construction work to India or China. These are American jobs. These are Minnesota jobs. These are friends and neighbors. These are my two uncles and a lot of my friends who moved to the Twin Cities to get that higher rate, Representative Gunther, to make a bigger check because they do pay more here. And it's a tough profession because as we're all sitting here in suits and ties and business clothes, these people get a little dirty. And there's nothing wrong with that. Working on a job and coming home and having to wash your hands and maybe take a shower, there's nothing wrong with that. It's an honorable, noble profession. Like I said, that can't get outsourced. And you can look at the studies. We can get the Utah study and get facts. We can look at Wisconsin, who when they did this, they saved $4 million. But oops, it cost $12 million because the quality went down. So it was actually a net loss of $8 million. We can look at Kansas, where wages and benefits dropped, but there was no real gain to the taxpayers. We can look at Michigan, where there was no real gain to the taxpayers, but wages and benefits dropped. We can look at all the numbers, but at the end of the day, for me, it comes down to two things. This bill will cut wages. And in the job and economic opportunity budget division that we're in, I can't take a vote to cut wages of middle-class workers. And up in Westerberg, you said it best, I think, earlier when you said Minnesota is an island. And I'm fine with that. Because the alternative is going underwater for our middle-class workers and drowning them. And I don't want to do that today. So hopefully we can get rid of this bill and move on to creating jobs.
Yeah, thank you very much for your testimony. Representative Garofalo, do you have something very brief?
Well, just very briefly, Representative Sturgis went on record, so I wanted to be on record as well. And I make these comments as someone who's the brother of a sprinkler fitter and someone who's the son of a teamster. He said, I don't perceive the industry as looking at this as an anti-union, anti-worker, or in any way attacking middle-class workers. This is the most modest and reasonable of prevailing wage law reforms I've seen. And they're not asking for an attack, they're asking for accuracy. They're asking for accuracy in the reporting of data and the reporting and the construction of the prevailing wage. And I would like to see this committee approve it, and I'd like to see some sort of modest reform. The testifier spoke before about there are weaknesses in the existing system, and there's willing to work at the table on that, get to the table to solve that. And I would just like to see that, because this is, by even the most generous of assessments, an inaccurate prevailing wage law.
Okay, with that, the chair will lay over House File 3593 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill. Chairman Gunther, do you want to take testimony on the...
You get one people from out of town, you said?
Yeah.
Let's get those first.
Representative Erdahl, very quickly, can you at least we take your testimony from your out-of-town witness?
That was my out.
Chair will move House File 632 for... Do you recommend to pass and refer to the tax committee? We might not get to the motion by the time we're done here. Representative Erdahl, you want to queue up your witness first and maybe give a two-second introduction to the bill?
All right. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members.
You have to be real brief because we got another committee coming in here in about a nanosecond.
As quick as I can. House File 632 is a job creation bill, not meant to compete with Job Z, but to create jobs in distressed areas of mainly rural Minnesota. Areas that have a job growth rate of less than 15.6% or less than 25,000 population, provides a job credit for job creation in these areas of $15,000 spread out over 4 years. With me, Sue Persig. From Swift County, and
please introduce yourself and give your testimony. Our committee time's technically up, and we got just a couple minutes between committee meetings here. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm Susan Persig from the Swift County Rural Development Finance Authority.
Just a second. Can we be as quiet as possible in the back of the room so we can hear the testimony? Thank you.
Thank you. I am an economic developer in Swift County, and I look at this project or this bill as something that would add an arrow to our quiver, a tool in our toolbox, something in addition to JobZ and the other programs we have that would enable our smaller businesses and businesses that don't qualify for JobZ to do expansions that would give them an incentive to do that very easily.
Okay, questions from members? There is an amendment. Chair will move the DE4 amendments. Does that pretty much do what we were just talking about?
Yes.
Okay, questions from members? Seeing none. Representative Clark? No, just the DE amendment. All in favor of the DE4 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Clark, you have a question for the bill?
I'm sorry, I didn't realize there was a whole big amendment here. What's the difference, Representative Erdl, between the amendment and the bill?
Representative Erdl?
I believe it just updated it. The bill should be pretty much the same. It just changed the dates because this was introduced a year ago, and basically it moves it out one more year. So, therefore, the fiscal note is zero for the next 2 years, and the tails are $2.5 million a year. It starts, the effective date moves out to January 1st, 2007. So the bill is the same, it just changes the dates to make it more.
And Mr. Chair, what is the fiscal note on this?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Erdl.
It's zero for 2006, 2007.
Yeah.
2.5, 2.5, 2.5, 2.5.
So, Mr. Chairman, this is a tax credit of $2.5 million that will be available to counties outside the metro area.
Right.
Any county, or this is an eligible county.
No.
Representative Erdl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Once again, Representative Clark, it's for those counties who are non-entitlement counties. Who have a job growth rate of under 15.6% or population under 25,000. It's 62 counties that fit into one of those categories.
And Mr. Chairman, this goes to the employer or to the county?
It goes to the $150,000 in tax credits go to the county, and through their county commissioners or designee, the credits would be released.
And Mr. Chairman?
Representative Clark.
So last question. Is there any limit on how much a business can get from this? For example, if you had a very large business, could they eat up all the tax credits? Are there going to be some reserved for the small businesses? Is there any plan to try to look at large versus small in terms of this issue of who you're helping create jobs?
It would be up.
Representative Erdl.
It would be up to the county board, whether designee, to determine up to 10. Representative Clark, you are correct that one company could get 10. That would be the maximum, but it would be not likely.
I wonder if the witness maybe could respond to her understanding of how it's likely to be distributed.
At this point, I don't have any indication of how that would be distributed. Our local businesses expand sporadically, and sometimes they add a job or two, and sometimes they add 100 jobs. But most of the time, it's pretty small. We are a small county and have small businesses.
Is
that it? Okay. Thank you, Mr. I just wish I had a little more information. Maybe we could talk later.
Yeah, it will be going to taxes, too. This is not the final. Representative Erdl, a very, very brief comment.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a report on this. I'll see that you get the report. It's more detailed as to what it is.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. The chair renews his motion to House File 632 as amended. Be recommended to pass and re-refer to the tax committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion prevails. Okay.
Thank you very much.
The chair, Representative Sturridge, moves House File 3638 for possible inclusion in the omnibus bill, and the chair will lay it over for possible inclusion now, and we'll have the testimony later. Representative Sturridge and his witnesses are okay with that. So with that, we're adjourned.